I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama called on lawmakers to have courage, and he put a human face on health care reform at his appearance today in suburban Ohio. The president told a partisan crowd that he was speaking in the name of Natoma Canfield, a self-employed cleaning woman who was supposed to introduce him at the rally but couldn't because she just found out she has a recurrence of cancer. The president said Canfield wrote him to say she had to drop her coverage because her insurer kept increasing her monthly premiums, even though Canfield kept increasing her deductible.
Altogether, this woman paid $10,000 one year. But because she never hit her deductible, her insurance company only spent $900 on her care. All right, so the insurance company is getting $10,000, paying out $900.
Major proposals, too, health care, education, Wall Street, are all being rolled out today in Washington. Gail Shattuck is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us from Capitol Hill. And, Gail, first of all, we want to hear whether Natoma Canfield's story, will break through everything that's happening today. But you say this is the biggest news day in Washington so far this year. Is it really?
It is. I mean, all of these are issues that we've been waiting to see legislative language on, especially in the Senate, for months. And the Senate Banking Committee is releasing its solution to what to do about Wall Street, the education report from the president, his plan to renew No Child Left Behind, lands on Capitol Hill today. And, of course, the big question is, what is the House going to do to fix the Senate bill to get enough votes to pass something that could conceivably help the case you just raised?
So all of this going on this week, and, the question is, so many initiatives. What are you hearing there in Washington? If the president does succeed in passing health care reform, will it help or hurt these other initiatives?
Well, the conventional wisdom has been that you just can't do that many things. You really should focus on health care. But I think there, just in the last couple of weeks, there has been, to my sense, a real firming within Democratic ranks that they are looking at the prospect of heading into midterm elections with really no significant accomplishments. Health care, if it drifts into nothing, suggests that maybe Democrats can't govern, and that is something that is just unacceptable. And this pulling together, this sense that, look, we sink together, we swim together, but we really have to give up on the Republicans and just go forward on our own. I'm hearing that Democrats think that not only will this take health care over the finish line, but it might also give a lot of momentum to these other issues as well.
Well, and President Obama got this crowd pretty excited today, especially with the story of Natoma Canfield. And some are wondering, why haven't we heard this kind of story before? The story that we heard, for instance, on our sister show, On Point. This is a fellow named Jonathan from Colchester, Connecticut, a Republican who was asked why he said he was never going to vote Republican again. Let's listen.
This is a disgrace. This is absolutely, I'm just blown away by this. Do they really believe what they're saying? When I hear it Sunday morning, I almost get sick to my stomach. I watched my Republican father die with no insurance. This has got to stop.
Gail Shattuck, why aren't we hearing from the Obama White House more of these voices, more of stories like Natoma Canfield's?
Well, they've tried, but I think it has just been deluged in all of the advertising that undermines the bill. And I think the Democrats are also coming to the point where they're saying, look, we have to finish something this week or next, because we cannot go home to another recess with Tea Party activists or protesters against health care. We can defend a bill. What we cannot defend is a concept, and what we really can't defend is inactivity.
Well, if the House does pass the proposal, this is going to set up a wild parlementary rumble, everybody's been talking about. Here's a sentence we hear. The House will declare that the Senate has passed the bill, too. What does that mean?
That is a trick that can go through the Rules Committee, where the Rules Committee can deem the Senate bill passed if the House passes the package of fixes, thus sparing House Democrats from what is, for many of them, a very painful vote. They don't like the Senate bill. They don't like that it doesn't have a public option. They don't like that it sets up barriers to undocumented workers here that might want to pay for their own health insurance. They don't like the abortion language, on and on. But if you can somehow just sign off on the fixes and then have it deemed that you have voted for the Senate bill, it's a little bit more cover. And some people think that's the direction that the Rules Committee may go midweek.
Well, it'll be a part of what's going to be a wild week from what we hear in every corner. Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thanks for helping us lay it out.
You're welcome.
Well, as Gail said, Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut is unveiling his financial reform plan this afternoon. Is Tim Geithner the guy to shepherd it through? Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner played a central role in shaping the government response to the financial crisis, first as head of the New York Federal Reserve and then as President Obama's Treasury Secretary. As Joshua Green writes in the April issue of The Atlantic, Geithner's foes on the right say he socialized banking. On the left, they say he wasted money on fat cats, coddled Wall Street, and then brought President Obama, a former community activist no less, under Wall Street's spell as well. But Joshua Green also writes, an argument can be made that Geithner prevented a full-blown depression at a relatively small cost that is already being recouped, and he was successful because he's so close to Wall Street. But going forward, that closeness may prevent Geithner from understanding the need for reform. Joshua Green is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from the magazine studios in Washington. His article is entitled How Timothy Geithner Saved the Economy and Why He's the Wrong Man to Fix Wall Street. Josh, welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be with you again.
Let's start with the first part. You say that Geithner had a three-pronged plan. First, the Fed lowering borrowing costs to nearly nothing. Second, the stimulus bill, get money out to help private spending. And third, getting money into banks. You write that Geithner made a daring break from form here. What do you mean?
Geithner spent the majority of his career in the Clinton Treasury Department, and what he did there was to help devise responses to all the emerging market crises in the 1990s in Mexico and Russia and Korea. It's usually the government that steps in and recapitalizes these banks with taxpayer money. What was novel about Geithner's plan, and I think still largely misunderstood or unknown by the public and by many people in Washington, is that he managed to come up with a way to do this that didn't involve a lot of taxpayer money. Instead, he got private investors to step up and to recapitalize these banks.
But as you know, the perception is that it was taxpayer money, and it was called TARP.
There was certainly taxpayer money put into the banks. But if you look at studies of past financial crises, typically the cost to a country is somewhere between 5% and 10% of GDP, which would put the figure for the United States somewhere around $2 trillion. We put in $700 billion for the TARP, some of which hasn't been spent, most of which will be paid back. And right now, if you take an estimate of what it's probably going to cost U.S. taxpayers, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 billion. And just to give you an idea of scale, the savings and loan scandal of the late 1980s, early 1990s was a fraction of the size of our current financial crisis. This one could end up costing taxpayers even less than that one did. So for all the criticism, some of it justified, I think, of the administration, they really have done something quite remarkable here. They've done a very lousy job of explaining it and helping the public to understand.
Well, and help us more now, because, as you said, instead of using more taxpayer money, Geithner's plan was to get investors to invest in banks. And to do that, he came up with stress tests. Now, critics said the tests weren't tough enough, but what happened? How much investment money did go into banks to offset, as you said, only the maybe $100 billion that would end up coming from taxpayers?
But when the stress tests were announced last March, one camp thought, oh, this is just pretext to allow the government to nationalize, to take over a lot of these ailing banks. The other response was, oh, these are bogus and they're weak, and they're really meant to prevent the banks from having to do anything they don't want to do, and that we're going to wind up in a situation like Japan in the 1990s where the banks just limp along for years and years and years and the economy never recovers. In fact, the point really was to kind of halt the panic and stop the contagion. And Geithner's thinking was, you know, we're going to go in as the government and make the banks open their books, and we're going to take a close look at kind of what they have, how strong they are, and then kind of war game several different scenarios of what happens if the economy gets worse, what happens if it gets much worse. We'll see how these banks are set up to survive these various scenarios, and we'll make a decision about how much more money they need. And then what we're going to do is we're going to tell the banks, well, you need to raise X amount of dollars. You can go out and you can raise it from private investors if you don't want us, the government, being involved. But if you can't, we're going to step in, it's not going to be something you want. In fact, the stress test really worked about as Geithner had hoped they would. I think even better than Geithner hoped they would, because if you look at where the Dow bottomed out last March, it was right around this time. Subsequent to that, when the results of the test were announced in May, you know, a lot of these big banks needed tens of billions of dollars, and for the most part have been able to raise that money in the private sector. And so today, the U.S. government has put in about $7 billion to banks since Obama became president. But banks have also managed to raise about $140 billion from private investors. So if you look at where the money's coming from, Geithner really did manage to shift the burden onto the private sector and away from taxpayers and the government.
Geithner had to navigate this carefully, because if your goal is to get investors to invest in banks, you can't beat the banks up too much, because then why would investors want to invest in them?
One of the unfortunate side effects of this plan from a political point of view is that if you're counting on the private market to inject this money into these ailing banks, you have to tread very carefully or you'll scare them off. And what private investors are mostly scared of is that the government would arbitrarily step in and do something like, you know, fire a CEO of a big bank or kind of change the rules in mid-course. And if that were to happen, that would frighten them off and the Geithner plan would have fallen apart.
In fact, you're right. There was a huge dust-up in the White House between Lawrence Summers and Timothy Geithner over whether or not to fire Ken Lewis, CEO of Bank of America. Geithner didn't want to do it.
Basically, the long-running battle during the first year of the Obama administration within the economic team was, how aggressive can we be? And Geithner wanted to be very hands-off for the reasons we just talked about. He didn't want to spook the private market. So from a political standpoint, people in the administration like Summers wanted to fire Ken Lewis, who performed very badly. Doing so, I think, would have been politically advantageous to the Obama administration. It would have sent a message to voters that, you know, banks aren't being coddled. But Geithner opposed that because it would have frightened off private investors. And what's so interesting about that example, which hasn't been reported until now, is that Obama sided with Geithner and Lewis was not fired.
And, in fact, later he was forced out by shareholders. So given the numbers you just gave us, a huge amount of private investment in banks as opposed to public investment, and the seeming sort of success of that program, given, you know, how the markets are now, what is Timothy Geithner's response to both the left and the right's criticism? On the right, that he's an agent of socialism. On the left, a lapdog of Wall Street.
I think basically his reaction is frustration and exasperation. As he says to me in this piece, to people on the right, I would submit, by having the private sector come in and recapitalize these banks rather than the government, we've avoided having the government more invested and more active in the economy than it otherwise would be. To people on the left, he would say, by having the private sector recapitalize banks, we freed up enormous amounts of taxpayer money that can now be used to pursue things like healthcare reform, energy, what have you, you know, the whole kind of panoply of liberal policy goals.
Well, Geithner and the people at Treasury may feel they prevented a depression, but people are furious. And that brings us to the second part of Joshua Green's article in the April Atlantic, Why Tim Geithner is the Wrong Man to Fix Wall Street. We'll have more with Josh in a minute on that topic. And later in the program, the very latest from Israel. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Joshua Green of The Atlantic. He profiles Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner in the April issue, a piece that's headlined How Timothy Geithner Saved the Economy and Why He's the Wrong Man to Fix Wall Street. Joshua, let's talk about the second part of your title now. You write that as head of the New York Fed, before he became Treasury Secretary, Geithner saw that the new financial instruments, derivatives, were a big potential problem, dangerous. So why didn't he tell anyone? You say it has something to do with the culture he came from. Tell us more about that.
The history of his professional life is really one of being a superstar within the bureaucracy in Washington, especially in the Treasury Department. And I came away thinking of Geithner sort of like the good soldier whose life is the regiment. He's an honest and admirable guy in his own way, and yet his worldview, I think, tends to be circumscribed by, you know, whatever institution he's working in. The New York Fed was a good example. Geithner came in 2003 and realized that, you know, these derivatives were really potentially dangerous, and he went about trying to bring about some reforms, which he did. As a point of comparison, comparison, you can take the example of Brooks LeBourne, who was the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission during the second Clinton administration, who was also very worried about derivatives. Bourne went out and just created a real kind of firestorm in Washington by warning about these, by saying they were dangerous and they ought to be regulated, and really kind of putting her career on the line. Geithner didn't, and he knew these things were bad and potentially dangerous. And I asked him, I said, why, you know, if you recognize this, why didn't you come out and do more? And his response was, you know, I didn't feel it was my place. And so I think that sort of gets to the limits of what Geithner is willing to do. He's very much kind of an inside player who works within the boundaries of whatever institution he's working for. And within those boundaries, I think he's good and he's effective. And his reforms at the New York Fed on derivatives probably did save, you know, enormous amounts of money. But they basically did something that was good for the banks and good for the New York Fed, but did not go as far as kind of going out and being Chicken Little and kind of warning the rest of the world, these are dangerous things and they need to be regulated.
Well, now going forward, speaking of regulation and reform, former Fed Chair Paul Volcker has been brought back onto the scene. He's pushing the president to move banking to back to where it once was, you know, separating, you know, simple savings from investing the way the Glass-Steagall legislation intended it. Economists like Simon Johnson agree, but you say Geithner isn't in the rolling back camp. He's in the containment camp. Explain that.
Yeah, I sort of described financial reform as breaking into two camps. And what I used basically the terminology that people used to use regarding the Soviet Union and the Cold War. There was one camp that was in favor of rollback. There was another camp that was more interested in kind of containment, that sort of believed, you know, you really can't turn back the clock. What we're going to do instead is try and strengthen and contain the system as it exists today as best we can. Volcker is a rollback guy. Geithner is very much a containment guy. And that's significant because Geithner and Larry Summers, another containment guy, are really the two people who wrote the administration's reform plan, which was unveiled last June, which was passed through the House last winter, and which is really the basis for the slightly weakened version that is being debated in the Senate right now. What's troubling about that is if you believe that this really was on scale with the Great Depression and called for similarly ambitious reforms, then you're probably not going to be happy with what the administration put forward or what looks like is going to pass through the House in the Senate when the Senate finally finishes up and gets signed by President Obama. So Geithner, I'm not, you know, on a policy sense, I'm not sure he's aggressive enough. And in terms of being a guy who's credible and able to sell this to the public, I think he's damaged because he's really someone who's associated with Wall Street, with defending the institutions, not someone who would put the public interest front and center.
Well, and as you say, even if, as he says, he feels he's saved the public and served the public by preventing a depression, he's not going to get credit for that. And to the House plan, it doesn't have as much oversight as some had hoped. Yes, it requires more capital, more transparent trading, a consumer agency, but it also carves out loopholes for derivatives trading. And there's talk of killing the consumer agency. We spoke to House Financial Committee Chair Barney Frank recently, and he told us he thinks the administration made a mistake, not striking while the iron was hot right after the crisis and doing financial reform before health reform. Do you think now, even if lawmakers are hearing what people are saying and feeling that anger, can they respond to it with more reform?
No, I think sort of the depressing coda to all this is that they can't, because the horse has kind of left the barn. And these reforms are not nearly as strong as I think a lot of people would like them to be. So there's really no reason to believe that Congress, after passing these reforms, is going to turn around and decide to pass even tougher reforms. I think this is as good as we're going to get, and it might not be good enough.
And is there some irony there? Because, as we said, there's anger on the streets. Republicans are taking advantage of that anger at the White House, but some of the same Republicans are the ones voting against reform.
Yeah, it's not just Republicans. It's a lot of Democrats too. I mean, you know, Washington D.C. is different than the rest of the country. You know, historically, going back to the New Deal era, it was Democrats who were, you know, trust busters, and they were opposed to Wall Street. That stopped being true in the late 1970s, and especially in the 80s and the 90s.
Just flesh that out a little more, because it's easy to see how politicians might have seen which way the winds were blowing in the 90s when everybody was making buckets of money. Given that it's imploded, why isn't there a shift in thinking?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. I mean, when you, you know, a lot of people sort of attribute it to money and Wall Street giving money to the parties, and that's true to an extent. But the entire intellectual framework behind deregulation is not just, you know, a conservative Republican idea. Democrats believed in it too. And if you're a member of Congress, especially if you're a senior member of Congress, a committee chairman, you know, you came of age during the 1980s and the 1990s when everybody believed, or just about everybody believed, that this was good. The other fact of it is, you know, senators and congressmen are generally insulated from this sort of thing. The people they talk to tend to be lobbyists, interest group people. You know, they don't spend their Saturday afternoon, you know, wandering through the aisles of Walmart talking to real people who are affected by this sort of thing. So I think that there's just a real limit to what can be done. And the fact that so much of the attention in the last year has been focused on healthcare, has been focused on energy, has been focused elsewhere, has just allowed this to slide.
Well, it may be more obvious to them come November. Joshua Green, senior editor of The Atlantic. You can read his article about Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. It's fascinating, at our website, hereandnow.org. Josh, thanks so much.
You bet. Great to be with you.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this. We're being told is the biggest news day of the year, from health reform to financial reform. Just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us, or scroll down and leave a comment. That's hereandnow.org. America's largest office pool is underway. College basketball's ultimate tournament, March Madness, gets into full swing this Thursday. So we want to take a look at the men's teams, or as Bob Ryan writes with his impeccable grammar, who's kidding whom? Kansas, Kentucky is the game we want to see. Bob Ryan, Boston Globe sports columnist, joins us on the line. Bob, make your case for Kansas, Kentucky in that last bracket.
They are the two best teams. They have had the best body of work. They have the most weaponry. That Kansas is the most complete team in the country. They are led by a senior point guard named Sharon Collins. Do have a classic old-fashioned center who can cause you a lot of trouble named Cole Aldridge. Do have a young freshman wingman named Xavier Henry, who can be very, very explosive and have sufficient depth, and are well coached by Bill Self, who led them to a championship only 2 years ago. Case for Kentucky, the single most raw talented team in America, with three great freshmen: John Wall, who's a spectacular point guard and will be the number one pick in the draft coming forthcoming; DeMarcus Cousins, a very talented, although a bit volatile center, but he is growing up quickly, who will be the number two or three pick in the country this year; and Eric Bledsoe, a terrific point guard who would be even getting even more publicity if we're at another school, and a junior forward named Patrick Patterson, who will be in the top, well, I'd say 5 to 8 picks in the draft whenever he chooses to come out. And they're coached by John Calipari, who's gotten the 2 Final Fours. They are the teams that I want to see, and I think most neutral fans would want to see play for the championship.
And so you got Kansas, the top overall seed. They begin Thursday against Lehigh. Kentucky, the top seed in the East. They also begin Thursday in New Orleans against East Tennessee State.
Yes.
Okay, so there's some teams that didn't make it. You say you're not crying for them, but just a couple that, aren't there any that you think should
be? Yes, the one I thought about in retrospect after I wrote was probably Mississippi State, which did lose in overtime to Kentucky yesterday, and which has a really dangerous player named Jarvis Vornado, who I think, had they gotten in, would have been a team no one would want really wanted to play. But I think they feel very, very down today, because they came so close within a second of beating Kentucky yesterday. Really, it didn't dawn on me they wouldn't make it. The other team that seems to always have an annual complaint is Virginia Tech, but if you look at their record, they do nothing in the pre-conference, and then Illinois in the Big Ten, but they had lots of ups and downs. I don't feel sorry for them either.
Who are the sleepers?
The annual sleeper is Butler. Butler's ranked 5th this time. They've won 20 in a row. They are always knocking on the door. They have a tough draw in the first round with UTEP, but I think they will beat them, and they could always cause trouble. An Eastern team to keep your eye on is Siena. Siena is heavily favored by all the pundits to win a 13-4 game over 4th-ranked Purdue, who are missing their best player, Robbie Hummel, unfortunately, and who are not playing well. Siena could cause some trouble. They were in the tournament last year. They beat Ohio State. They lost to Louisville. Keep your eye on Siena.
A couple others you mentioned, St. Mary's in Providence.
Oh, I love this game. St. Mary's in Richmond. St. Mary's comes from the West Coast Conference, which has been dominated for a dozen years by Gonzaga. And they finally toppled. They got over the Gonzaga jinx. They really whacked them by 19 in their championship game last Monday night. They have a lot of Australians that's good day, mate. They got inside, outside potential. I like them a lot. When Richmond is a tough opponent for them. Richmond is a savvy team. That's an unfortunate matchup for St. Mary's. I think they probably won't get by them. But if they do, they're going to be trouble for the next game, which would be Villanova. I think that they would really feel good about themselves if they won that game.
Bob Ryan, by the way, what's the ethics of all this? Do you do brackets?
You know, it depends. I'm not big on the brackets thing. I just care about the competition and the matchups and the basketball part. But if there's an opportunity before, if they present a bracket to me in the office, I like to I play along, throw in my $5 like everybody else. We should not tell anybody.
We won't tell us all, of course.
But I don't get swept away in the brackets. And I really don't like making predictions, even though they put a gun to my head every year and make me do it. But I do feel strongly that we will feel a sense of disappointment, we being all the neutrals, if we don't see Kansas and Kentucky. Kansas has a tough road. They give them the number one seed, and then they put them in the toughest region by far. There's minefields all over the place. Ohio State, Georgetown, Maryland, Tennessee. This is the by far the glamour region is the Midwest. And if Kansas gets to the just getting to the regional, they're going to have earned it. And getting to the Final Four will be a great achievement. I don't understand how you make a team the number one overall seed and then clearly load up their bracket.
Bob Ryan, Boston Globe sports columnist, as always. We'll compare, you know, in the weeks to come.
And one more team to watch, Baylor Bears. I'm high on Baylor.
Okay.
All right.
Actually, a whole bunch more teams to watch. Later this week, we'll take a look at the women's NCAAs. But right now, we're going to take a break. When we come back, what did Prime Minister Netanyahu say today from Israel in response to U.S. Urging over the weekend? That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a speech today that past construction of Jewish settlements in East Jerusalem has in no way hurt the Palestinian people. But observers would say a proposal for new construction has derailed peace talks and severely impacted U.S.-Israel relations. The U.S. has called on Israel to cancel the planned construction of 1,600 new housing units in East Jerusalem after last week's surprise announcement of them. And the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. told fellow diplomats that the current crisis between the two countries is as serious as it's been in decades. Joining us from Jerusalem is the BBC's Middle East correspondent Paul Wood. Paul, first of all, tell us more about the Prime Minister's words today.
Well, he's just been speaking in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, on the occasion of the visit of the Brazilian president. But Mr. Netanyahu did address the issue of settlement building. You may remember that the US Vice President Joe Biden was embarrassed, some would say humiliated, by the announcement of 1,600 new homes on occupied land during his official visit. Mr. Netanyahu did not change his position one iota in that speech. He said that if you drive 5 minutes from the Knesset, you come to neighbourhoods like Ramat Shlomo, the place where these 1,600 homes will be built, Pisgat Ze'ev, places where half of Jerusalem's population, as Jerusalem is defined by Israel, live. And there is nobody in the Knesset, said Mr. Netanyahu, who would think that these are places which would be given away. So this is, I think, the reality of his right-wing coalition. If the coalition is going to stay together, then he cannot talk about stopping building in East Jerusalem, even if that's what he intends to do. Now, the US is so angry because there was allegedly a private deal for building to stop, and then there was this huge announcement in the middle of a vice presidential visit. And now, as Michael Oren, the ambassador, Israel's ambassador in Washington, says, one of the worst breaches in relations for 35 years.
And just remind us, Paul, maybe we should have just a little bit of context here, why Jerusalem is so disputed.
Well, Jerusalem is the focus of the conflict. First of all, this is at its root a religious conflict, and you have what Jews call the Temple Mount, what Arabs or Muslims anyway call the Haram al-Sharif, these religious sites which are disputed. Both sides claim it as their capital. It's the eternal and undivided capital of Israel, said Mr. Netanyahu in the Knesset today. The Arabs too want the capital of a future Palestinian state to be there. And the problem with places like Ramat Shlomo, this is land that Israel captured in 1967, which the Palestinians and most of the international community certainly regard as illegally occupied, but to Israel is an integral part of Jerusalem. Geographically, it's very close to the heart of the city. Now, the reality is that in any future peace deal, this is land which Israel would almost certainly keep. The boundaries of a Palestinian state would be just outside. But it is a neuralgic issue for the Palestinians, and they see what they call new facts on the ground being created all the time. Israel essentially defining the borders of both future Palestine and of the future shape of Israel unilaterally, And it's always been a condition that the Palestinians have had that all settlement buildings should freeze, including East Jerusalem. And I think they're now taking advantage of the fact that Israel's on the diplomatic back foot to press that claim.
Well, and you say that there was a behind-the-scenes deal going on to stop the building?
Well, we don't know that for certain. That's in the nature of a behind-the-scenes deal.
Right.
But the assumption is that to get the Palestinians into these talks, they had to swallow a lot. The so-called settlement freeze that Israel announced is not really a settlement freeze. It's a freeze in new permits, and building on about 3,000 new dwellings will continue in East Jerusalem, would continue on public buildings in the occupied West Bank. So the Palestinians had kind of marched to the top of a hill and had to be brought back down by the Americans. And one of the things that it was allegedly understood would happen was that while Mr. Netanyahu would not announce a cessation of building in East Jerusalem, essentially that's what would happen. And of course, 1,600 new homes on occupied land made it very, very clear to the Palestinians that this deal had not taken place. And the Palestinians themselves have got a lot of problem with their own Arab street, as it's called. They needed political cover to get into these talks, and the 1,600 new homes completely removed that political cover. And bear in mind, the Americans are the ones artificially resuscitating this process. It wouldn't exist without them. And then for this to happen when Mr. Biden was here really was, as one Israeli newspaper put it, a very loud slap in the face.
Well, it's been reported now that Hillary Clinton made a list of demands over the weekend, including that Netanyahu investigate that announcement. Was it an honest mistake, as he originally said, or deliberate? That Israel reverse the construction approval, make a gesture towards Palestinians to renew trust, something like releasing prisoners, and officially declare talks will deal with issues like Jerusalem security, water. What is the sense that these demands will be met?
This kind of reminds me of a famous anecdote about when Mr. Netanyahu was last prime minister in 1996 and President Clinton was in office. And Mr. Clinton allegedly turned to one of his aides after a particularly frustrating meeting with Mr. Netanyahu and said, look, you know, who's the superpower here? So I think the phone call from Mrs. Clinton, US Secretary of State, on Friday was all about reminding Israel that really the US is the superpower. The US is Israel's key ally, and an ally which, for instance, on the issue of Iran's supposed nuclear ambitions, Israel will need. And this is an issue that Mr. Netanyahu himself says is the key issue and the key security challenge facing his country. The problem is he's now got to choose between good relations with the United States and perhaps keeping his coalition government together. This decision, which he's tried to pass off as a low-level bureaucratic mix-up, came about because of right-wing elements in the coalition trying to appeal to their own right-wing and religious constituency. Now he has got to either repudiate them or repudiate the United States. It's a very difficult choice for him, and indeed some of his supporters are quoted in the Israeli press this morning as accusing the White House of trying to bring down his government.
Well, here in the U.S., we have columnists like Tom Friedman saying over the weekend, why can't Israel see how much the U.S. has done for Israel? Why can't they just stop something as simple as the 1,600 units? You know, what's the different debate where you are?
Well, Tom Friedman's argument was that Joe Biden should have simply, as Friedman put it, snapped his notebook shut and got back on Air Force Two or Air Force One, whichever plane he flew in on, and just left. Instead, what we had was a little bit of anger. Mr. Biden was 90 minutes late for the state dinner with the Netanyahus. Partly, I think, he was working out the line to take with President Obama, who, by all accounts, was absolutely furious at this development. But then the following day, there was a kind of show them the love speech from Mr. Biden, who said, well, on the one hand, of course, Israel made a very bad error in doing this, but we're still very close to them. And for 37 years as a public official, I've been a leading supporter of Israel. What Tom Friedman was saying was, to make the point serious, the Americans should just have left. We've seen a lot of back and forth on this. Mr. Biden was upbeat, apparently, in briefing reporters on the plane on the way back, saying there was still hope for the talks. Then over the weekend, we had David Axelrod, a very close aide of Mr. Obama's, talking about an affront to the US and an affront to Mr. Biden. Hillary Clinton on CNN talking about an insult to the United States. So you kind of get the feeling that the White House, too, is a little bit back and forth on this. But at the end of the day, George Mitchell is here to start talks, and the talks ain't starting yet.
Yeah. That's the BBC's Middle East correspondent, Paul Wood, in Jerusalem. Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The world of makeup often seems frivolous.
You need Helena Rubinstein's revolutionary new Mascara-Matic, the first automatic mascara applicator.
But this month, a PBS documentary makes the case that while we might think of cosmetics as an industry that only takes women at face value, meaning only values their face, At one time, it was an industry led by women who aimed to empower other women. The film is called The Powder and the Glory, and it's the story of rivals Elizabeth Arden and Helena Rubinstein, heard here at the height of their influence.
Every woman, no matter what her age, can look from 10 to 15 years younger.
I suppose I have been included in the newsreel because the biggest news of the day is not the naval agreement, not even prohibition, but the return of the natural waistline.
That's Elizabeth Arden, before her Helena Rubinstein. Through their personal stories, their salons, their empires, they literally changed the face of America and created an industry. The two filmmakers who tell their story in The Powder and the Glory join us now. Anne Carol Grossman, welcome.
Thank you.
And Arnie Riesman, who public radio listeners may know from his star turn on the program Says You, joins us as well. Arnie, welcome to you.
Thank you, Robin. Welcome. Welcome to all of us.
Yes, welcome. And, you know, in the film, we should rush to say you also acknowledge C.J. Walker, the African-American woman
yeah.
who also built a beauty empire and died in 1918. But you tell the story of Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden, both immigrants, Helena from Poland, Elizabeth Arden from Canada, both from humble beginnings. Why was makeup a place where they could succeed?
Well, in those days, there weren't very many business opportunities for women, but makeup was considered a province that was okay for them. It was something that women used and or that women could conceivably use. Of course, when they started, makeup was considered unsavory. It was okay for performers. It was also associated with prostitution in those days. This was when Helena Rubinstein came to the United States, was 1914. So it hadn't yet become
right.
proper.
Right. And in fact, when women did buy makeup for many years, they wrapped it in brown paper.
Right.
So nobody would see.
So nobody would know.
So Arnie, how did they start?
Well, they started in very different ways. Elizabeth Arden basically started, we're talking going back to like the first decade of the 20th century, and Elizabeth Arden came to the United States without much in the way of any money in her pocket and went to work for some women who were doing the beginnings of cosmetics and little salons, and she started working away that way. Rubinstein, who had a complete falling out with her father and left Poland, went to a family that was living in Australia and opened her first shop with her mother's cold cream in Melbourne. Mm. But eventually, they both would meet in New York.
Well,
the interesting thing is even they never really meet.
Right,
but
they never meet. It's amazing how their lives are parallel. You illustrate this with a very clever animation of two queens on a chessboard. You know, they set up shop near each other. They're, you know, on the same streets in New York practically. Mm-hmm. But they never, did they really never meet? And
well, we sort of figure that they were in some of the same places, but they never actually carried on a conversation. And we think that this was really by design because their competition was part of what made them successful. And yeah, if they met, what if they liked each other?
Right.
That would have been a disaster.
They were driven by the fact that they didn't know each other.
Well, it's become part of the story. Mm-hmm. And the other part of the story is how America changed over the decades, and
right.
they took advantage of it. You had the flappers. You had the suffragette movement. What role would the suffragette movement play in, like, lipstick, Ann Carroll?
Well, Elizabeth Arden apparently saw a march, a suffragette march, going down Fifth Avenue, and she said, oh, this looks like something good to me. And she went down to the march and joined in because she saw that this was a possible way to get business. And what happened was that the women in the march wore lipstick as a sign of independence. Then lipstick started to become associated with independence, the so-called new woman, and that took off from there.
It's so interesting because later women would stop wearing makeup mm-hmm. as a sign of independence, but at that time they were being told they couldn't, so they did. And then there's all these other elements. You show how magazines, movies, all these different external things sort of brought makeup more and more into the culture. But interesting, it was during the Depression
right.
that the sale of cosmetics took off.
Right.
Why?
It was a chance for relief from not having to get yourself all worked up over the fact that you didn't have any money. What little money you had, you spent on making yourself feel better.
And even today, lipstick is a barometer
mm-hmm.
of the economy.
Right.
Kind of when people have discretionary income, if they can't afford anything else, they might buy
right.
a lipstick. But Ann Carroll, what else did these women become? Because it wasn't just about their product, it was them.
They became icons. I mean, they were household names very quickly. They created a kind of an aura, kind of a lifestyle. For example, Helena Rubinstein was an art collector, and so she created a whole Art Deco are around who she was and what that lifestyle was like. And Elizabeth Arden bred thoroughbred horses. And the races, according to Kitty Carlisle in the film, were something that everybody went to in the 1930s. And Elizabeth Arden was always there. And so she became an icon in that way.
Well, they also seem to be aware of a holistic approach to women. I mean, they set up salons. They they talked about body image,
body
too.
Body image, right. Yeah. Spas. You're right. Salons. I mean, they really had a tremendous influence over how women started looking at themselves.
Plus, they would be, in this day and age, cabillionaires.
Well, they were then, too, for all practical purposes.
Yeah.
By the 1950s, they were the first and second richest women in the United States.
But then, you know, department stores come along, you know, so they're perfectly positioned for that kind of expansion. Movies come along. They're there for that. But they missed television.
Right. Just looked like a passing fad to both of them for all practical purposes. And it just didn't. And that, this is where we have the rise of Charlie Revson, Revlon, which saw the opportunity in television and bankrolled the $64,000 question.
And that does bring us to the 60s, where, you know, anybody who passed through that era knows Rubenstein and Arden started to be, you know, sort of your grandmother's makeup
right,
people.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
People weren't, except for older people, they weren't going to salons and spending a whole day having a beauty treatment and lunch and all of that stuff anymore. And so that was the way they had always done things. And I think they couldn't let go of that.
For the most part, they wrote off young women. I mean, they saw their clientele as the women that grew up with them. Eventually, they hit a wall.
Because young people were looking at Twiggy.
When I first did that makeup, I did it for me. I mean, you know, I was a teenager, I was a mod. And I actually copied the lines underneath, which, you know, became known as Twiggy's, from my, I had a rag doll, you know, with the painted eyes. And I was playing around copying that. But I didn't think at that time, I'm doing this so loads of girls will copy, because I didn't know at that point, when I was doing that, that I was going to become this world-famous model.
So, Anne Carol Grossman, Arnie Riesman, what do you think the legacy of Elizabeth Arden and Helena Rubinstein was?
I think it's not as much cosmetics as it is business. The fact that at a time when it was very difficult for women to do that, that they became incredibly successful, household names, icons, and they invented very many of the marketing and advertising techniques that are still common today. They invented that stuff.
By the way, they disliked each other to the end. What's the comment? I think it's Helena Rubinstein
about the
makes.
Horse?
Yeah.
Yeah. At one point, one of the thoroughbreds bit off a finger of Miss Arden while Miss Arden was feeding it, but she went right to the hospital and got the finger stitched back on. And when Helena Rubinstein heard this news, she basically said, "Oh, poor dear. I mean, do tell me, how is the horse?"
Tough cookies.
Yeah, tough cookies.
That's Arnie Riesman with Anne Carol Grossman. He's made the film The Powder and the Glory, which is airing on PBS stations. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Thanks so much, both of you, for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.